So One Eyed Markovitch is actually based on a true story that I heard. And it was so incredible that it took me a while to realize that it's a true story, because sometimes you feel like history is a better author than anybody else. And this true story is the story of a group of young men leaving a mandatory Palestine, going on a boat, sailing, leaving Israel, and sailing to Nazi Europe in the eve of Second World War. Everybody is just trying to get out of Europe, and here they are traveling into Europe. And the reason was that this man went on an operation to marry young Jewish women in Europe, and this way to get them out of Europe and into mandatory Palestine, because the British wouldn't let anybody in unless they were married to a citizen. So you have all the men trying to escape Europe, and then you have this ship of men going into Europe in this national heroic operation to save the life of women. But when I heard this story for the first time, it was a story of this heroic operation that went terribly wrong. Because at least in one case that I know about, when the ship came back to Israel carrying those married couple, they were all supposed to get fictively married and then to get a very quick divorce when they reach Israel. It was supposed to be the quickest marriage and the quickest divorce ever. So the rabbi was supposed to enter and to marry them all together in Europe, and then the rabbi was supposed to divorce them all in just a few seconds in Israel. But in one case, there was this one man that went all the way to Europe to rescue a woman, but when they reached Israel, he found out that he can't let her go. He refused to give her the get. And I heard this story, it was my first time in the house of my boyfriend, now the father of my two little kids. But then he was my boyfriend. It was the first time I came to meet his family. And we had this awkward silence that you have in those kind of events. And I was trying to find something to talk about. So he lived in the village, and I just pointed at the house there and asked, "Who lives there?" Which was my attempt on a conversation. And then they said, "Beautiful Bella lives there." So I was automatically a bit envy. Why is my boyfriend calling another woman beautiful Bella? And then he said, "Don't worry, beautiful Bella is not exactly my age right now. She's in her 80s. But she is the most beautiful woman that this village ever knew. And she was married to the most terrible villain that ever lived." And I thought, wow, for a story to keep on for so many years, that beautiful Bella is 80, but she's still considered the most beautiful woman in the village. And her husband has already passed away. He's gone. But they still talk about him as the most terrible person who ever lived. It's like they were holding on to this story. It's not mine, right? Because it could be. It was like they're holding on to this story. Like you have those villages in France where the entire village holds on to a recipe and they tell the recipe to each other for years. It was like the entire village held on to this story, telling it from father to son for years. And I think if a story is that strong to be passed from one person to another for so many years, there must be something to this story. So I went home after this event, and I was trained as a psychologist back then. And the psychologist in me just sprang into action, because I thought, what kind of man can do such a thing? What kind of man can go all the way to Europe to save a woman, doing the most noble thing, ending up doing the most terrible, selfish thing? It didn't fit. So I thought about this character, and I thought like a psychologist. I didn't want to judge him, because that's too easy to say he was just a villain. I tried to understand him. I tried to find a place within me that will be capable of holding someone against her will, his will. And it was then that I thought, that he must be not a villain, not a Disney guy character, but he should be this person that nobody ever bothers to look at. This kind of person that is so unremarkable that you meet him, you're introduced to him, but then the next day when you meet him on the street, you don't remember that you even saw him. You know those people, right? It's something in their face that just doesn't linger. And he lived his entire life being unnoticed, being the outsider in this great time of the foundation of Israel. He was this worm going through the history books. So you have the big tales in the history books, but and he's just there unnoticed. And I asked myself, what would happen if this guy would, by chance, in this fictive marriage, get to be married to the most beautiful woman he ever saw in his life? And this woman doesn't look at him for 1 second, even though he's saving her, because for her he's the instrument. Like she needs the boat to get on the boat to get to Palestine, she needs to be married to get to Palestine, but he's an instrument. And it is only the moment where he says, no, I'm not giving you the divorce. This is the first time in his life that he's being noticed. So it is the no that creates him as a person in the world. And even though he's hated right now, hate is still better than indifference. He cannot be any longer ignored. And for me, I was born in the 80s, and when I wrote this novel, I had all this question about why would somebody born in the 80s write a novel about something that happened years before she was born? And this comes back to David's remarks about trying to understand the Israeli story, which is something that I think both American Jews and Israelis, we're trying to understand the story while writing it. And maybe through writing it, we try to understand the story and to understand ourselves better. Because I grew up, I had one grandfather in the Haganah, in the Palmach, and the other grandfather in the Etzel. And they were always fighting in family dinners, always fighting who was more important in the foundation of Israel. And one day I was pretty young and I said, I don't get it, I just don't get the difference. You were both in the Machtarot, you were both like in the underground, it's the same, isn't it? And it was the one time that they just stopped fighting and they both looked at me and for one moment they both united in saying, how dare you? How dare you say it's the same? And my grandmother told me in this family dinner, Shabbat dinner, she said, you know, you walk the streets of Tel Aviv and you think Dizengoff is the best street to find a parking space. And you think Arlozorov is the street that has the best hummus. And you think Sokolov is the place to go for sushi. But these streets were people, that's what you don't realize. These streets were actually people walking and loving and fighting with each other. And I said, so I should read more history? And she said, it's not about history. Whenever you stand under the sign of a street, think about this person. Think, what would he like to eat for lunch? And when he entered the house, what would be the first piece of clothes that he will take off? Will it be his shoes? Will it be his shirt? What kind of person he was? So for me, writing One Night Markovitch was going back to this mythological past that I grew up on, because I didn't read Batman or Superman or DC or Marvel comic books. My superheroes were these grandfathers. We listened to their stories as if they really were Batman versus Superman trying to defeat the forces of evil. This was our mythology growing up. But as we grew up, we started hearing more stories about 48, stories that weren't always nice. And I remember coming to my grandfather as an adult asking him about things that we were not taught in high school, but I read that happened in 48. And I said, did it really happen? Because it was such a just war, so could it really happen? And he said, well, you know, just wars aren't always nice, and a war is a war. And you are now a grown-up girl, and you should be willing to look at your nation not through the eyes of an admiring child. Because the eyes of a child are admiring. You really look at them as superheroes or this Greek mythology. You have this country being born out of a womb of blood and fire. This is mythology. And as a teenager, you sometimes switch admiration in cynicism, saying not only that they were not superheroes, but they were bad people, and you start judging them and criticizing them. And I sometimes feel there's something in anti-Zionism, a bit of the teenager looking at his parents saying, I thought you were like God to me, and you're only human, and I hate you for that. We always hate our parents for not being as admirable as we thought we were. And part of growing up is to come to terms with this fact. Not the admiring eyes of a child, but also not the hateful eyes of a teenager. You try to combine both criticism and love and compassion. And maybe for the first time for me, to really look at my grandparents' story through eyes which are not just admiring and not just judgmental, but trying to do both at the same time. Writing a character like Malkovich, writing a character that is both noble, I hope there is something noble in Malkovich, I really hope, but at the same time, pathetic and selfish, saying that not just Malkovich is a person, but the generation of 48 has all of it in him. Just any person walking right now in the streets of New York has all of it in him. That's the DNA of the soul, right? We have all of that in us. And I kept thinking about this sentence by Yehuda Amichai, the Hebrew poet. He has this sentence saying, in Hebrew, גם האגרוף היה פעם כף יד פתוחה ואצבעות. Saying, the fist was once an open hand and fingers. And I find it to be one of the most beautiful sentences written in Hebrew. Because usually when we see a fist, we automatically judge. This man is a bully. This man is a villain. This man is an aggressor. But in literature, and I also feel in psychology, when you see a fist, you ask yourself, what happened? We don't come to the world like that. Babies don't come to the world with fists. We come to the world like that. So it used to be an open hand with fingers. What makes it be like this? And in Malkovich, when I heard the story of the clenched hand, of this man holding this woman against her will. And through writing, I tried to reopen the hand and to look at the fingers. And maybe the bigger journey was to think, could a hand that turned into a fist reopen again back to be an open hand with fingers? And I'm talking about Malkovich here, but for me this was also a question about the Israeli society. Sometimes when I look at us, at the Israeli culture today, at the Israeli society, at the Israeli government, I see the fist. And I think, but it used to be an open hand with fingers, so what went wrong? And can it still open up once again? And now I will move from One Eyed Malkovich to Waking Lions. Waking Lions is a contemporary novel. It's written in a completely direct language. How do you say Mishlav? Mishlav, like the way you use the language. Like high language or more literary language versus more everyday language. It was a much more daily language, because it's not a book about mythology. Markovitch is a book about mythology. It's trying to peep behind the scenes of mythology. Like when you have this picture of the Declaration of Israel, you know, this very famous picture. And I remember as a child standing before this picture thinking, I wonder if somebody in this picture really needed to go to the restrooms and had to wait the entire day because it was such a big day and everything was happening, and then there was the picture, and I always thought, I wonder if this guy in the side actually wanted to be in the middle and he was pushed aside by somebody else, and he's right now really happy for the foundation of Israel, but really occupied with, why did Ben-Gurion put me there and not here? So I like those moments when you have the big mythological thing happening and then to find the human inside of it. Just like I think painters, when they paint a bowl of fruits, will always put the memento mori, the sign of the skull, saying, but remember, you have the bowl of fruits, but you also have death, and you cannot ignore it because it will be kitsch if you ignore it. So When at Markovitch was about mythology, and Waking Lions was about waking up. So the language has nothing mythological or biblical in it. It's a very daily language. And it tells this story, it's also based on a real story that I heard of an Israeli backpacker. The real story is an Israeli backpacker that he was traveling the Himalayas and he accidentally hit a local Indian beggar, and he panicked, he was afraid of going to prison, and he left the man there. And when I heard this story, I thought, just like with Markovitch, that this guy doesn't look like the concept that I have of a bad man. We all have this concept, right, when we read in the news, what kind of person is capable of doing such a thing. And this guy, he was reading Meir Shalev and Marcus, and he had a guitar. He looked like the typical good Israeli guy. He looked like he could be me. And I was haunted by this question of, if I was driving back home late at night, I was pregnant while writing it, so I thought, if I was driving back home for my children, and I thought the first commandment for a parent is that you have to be there in the morning. When you bring a child to the world, you want to be there when he wakes up in the morning. If I was driving late at night, hitting somebody, is there any chance that I would be capable of leaving him on the side of the road to be back with my baby when she wakes up? And of course I have the easy answer, but that's the answer I would give you right now in this beautiful hall, you know, with the lights on. But then you think, sometimes the answer people give in the light when everybody is looking and watching is different than the decision that they will make in the middle of the night. Because I'm very interested with my 4-year-old with the way moral evolves. Because she's now in this phase in her life when she will not hit the baby brother when I'm in the room. But if I go out from the room for 2 seconds, you hear the wah! So it's interesting, because if she has the eye in the room, she will behave. And as we grow up, this eye is internalized, right? We have the internalized eyes of our parents. So that even if there's nobody in the room, we still have our parents watching. My grandmother passed away a few years ago, but I still have her with me saying, are you sure you want to wear this? Are you sure you want to say this? Are you sure you want to eat this? So I have her internalized eye inside of me. And my protagonist, this doctor, the eyes are always open. He's a doctor. He saves life. He's a very... he votes left wing, so he thinks he's a good liberal. He thinks of himself as a good man. And then this eye blink in the middle of the night, and he makes the decision to leave the man there. And I was wondering, about myself, about my protagonist, I was hoping that the reader will ask himself, if the chances of leaving a man of the side of the road are higher if this man speaks in a different language and from a different nationality, could that backpacker that I met leave an Israeli girl just like that in the side of the road? Or was the fact that it was a man from different color, different nation, doesn't share the same language? And once again, I have the right answer that I can give you, but I'm not sure that this is the real answer. So my protagonist had this hubris to think that he knows who he is and what he's capable of. And then he finds out that he is something different. And he also finds out that what he thought was unseen was indeed seen, because the next morning the refugee's wife comes knocking at his door, telling him that she was there and that she knows what happened, and starts blackmailing him. And at first I didn't have this character in my mind. I told my partner, who is also a writer, and I told him I want to write the story about the doctor and the hit-and-run accident. And he said, "Bevakasha, bevakasha, bevakasha, please, 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 don't write a 400 pages novel about somebody killing somebody feeling really, really guilty about it. First, because this novel was already written, right? It's a bestseller, Crime and Punishment. And so he said, don't write something that was already written. But second and more important, he said, because it's too easy. Because people can go on carrying their guilt their entire lives. It might be uncomfortable, it might hurt their back or their heart a little bit, but we are very well trained in walking the streets carrying our guilt with us, just like every person here, at least every woman, carries her purse. It can be heavy and uncomfortable, but we walk with it. And he said, this guy can live his entire life feeling guilty. He'll sleep no more for a few years, and then he will sleep. Or he will go to therapy and pay a lot of money and cry and leave it there and go outside and go on with his life. If you want to write the story, you have to shake his world. And that's how Sirkit, the Eritrean refugee, was born. She is an invisible person. She was unseen in the night of the accident, not just because literally she was unseen, but metaphorically because she is part of the unseen people in the Israeli society. If you walk the streets of Tel Aviv right now, if you walk Sderot Rothschild, Rothschild Boulevard, you won't see Eritreans in the restaurants. But if you open one door to the kitchen, then you will see all those people living in our city, but we don't see them, we don't bother to look at them, we don't want to look at them. It will ruin our lunch. And so this woman, this unnoticed woman, suddenly notices something that changes, it turns upside down the whole food chain of the Israeli society, because now it is the Israeli doctor being in the hands of this woman who is usually in the bottom of the Israeli food chain. And she forces him to look at her. And she forces him to look for the first time in his life at the backyard of the Israeli society, at the ex-territory of the Israeli mind, all the things that we don't want to think about. Think about the Israeli desert, not just as a geographical place, but also as a very mythological place, as a place where you can get lost. You can walk the desert for 40 years not finding your way, as a place where you can get redemption, where you can really find no more noise, you can actually hear your own thoughts, and maybe you can actually hear the Shekhinah, you can hear something in the desert. But also a place of the forgotten. And she forces him, for the first time in his life, to really open his eyes and look. And one of the things that interested me while writing it, and I didn't want to make a decision until the end, was, will it be a redemption novel? A novel about a person that did not want to see and is forced to look and is changed so that even if she won't be there tomorrow morning to blackmail him, he will still go and help the illegal immigrants, because she's blackmailing him to give medical treatment to illegal immigrants who are afraid to go to the Israeli hospital. Will he go there tomorrow morning if she won't be there? Has he changed from the inside? Or is he only going there because she blackmails him, because she forces him to? Will it be a redemption novel, or will it be like Orpheus going to the underground? You go there, and the only thing you want is to get back and to forget. So that if she will vanish tomorrow morning, he will say, this was just a bad dream, and now I'm coming back to my wife and my kids. Though this is not a dream, this is the reality we usually refuse to acknowledge. I think I will stop here for questions.
As you like. There's a lot of issues that you raise. Why don't you take...
Ken?
Okay, yeah. Invite questions, comments. I'm just curious, you spoke also about One Night Markovitch. How many of you have had a chance to read that book? Oh, some there. I'm sure you can order it online as we speak. But okay, let's open the floor for questions and comments. There we go.
Well, first of all, thank you for the wonderful and enthralling novel. It was troubling in lots of ways, and you really brought it home deeply. You talked about invisibility. And one of the things that I felt in the novel about invisibility was the implausibility of this medical clinic that no one saw. And I thought about it both, as a metaphor, but also as a reality. And I wondered whether you meant to infer, the reader to infer, that it was hiding in plain sight, and it was saying something about a society that refused to see that which was in front of them. And I wonder if you can, particularly in light of what's going on right now about the African migrants, whether you might comment on to what extent you wanted to kind of present that as a metaphor for the invisibility of the other.
Thank you for this question. When I started writing this, I asked, I did the research with a doctor working, Doctor Without Borders, and he's working with the Eritrean community. And I asked him, is it reasonable that something like this could happen? Because I don't want to write a whole novel which cannot be. And he said something that shook me. He said, you cannot believe how many things are going on right now in Tel Aviv, in your own city, which are completely, you don't see them. But I know, he was stealing medicines from the hospital he was working in to give medicines, because they do get emergency treatment, but they don't get the non-emergency treatment. So if, for instance, you have cancer, then you cannot get the medicines. And he was stealing medicine from the hospital and giving it. And he told me, it's so easy. It's so easy because nobody thinks about these people as people in need, as people being even capable of stealing. So I feel this is very much a metaphor for what's going on right now in the Israeli society. I'm thinking about the character of Liat, of the wife of the doctor. She's a detective. And being a detective investigating the crime committed by her partner, which is a cliché, but I thought about this cliché as having something very truthful in it. I sometimes think of clichés like templates, like DNA templates that duplicate themselves because they have something fit in them. I think in literature the same. You have templates duplicating because there's something fit in them. Like it's the evolution of a story. And the idea of somebody investigating a crime, think about Oedipus being the first detective. He's investigating a crime, right? There is a murderer, and Oedipus wants to find the murderer to bring back the peace. So he's investigating this murder, assuming that the murderer is outside, that there is external evil that we should cut. And the irony is that while he's looking for the external evil, he fails to acknowledge his own aggressive parts. So his detectives are always in quest for knowledge, and they're always missing the self-knowledge, the acknowledgement of one's own aggression. And this detective, Lady Liat, she's searching outside for this terrible person that can commit a hit-and-run accident. And she says to her husband, he's a racist, because if he hit an Ashkenazi girl, blonde girl from Omer, he wouldn't be able to leave her like that. So she assumes that there is an external evil, but she can't think about it as something happening in her own home, in her own house. And this comes back to your question about the Israeli society, because we always think of ourselves not as predators, not as lions, but as the lamb. As a society, we think of ourselves as the lamb and not as the aggressor. Liat think of her husband as this good person, not capable of doing. There's this moment in the novel when she enters the house and she takes off her gun, because you don't enter your own house carrying a gun. And then she takes off the uniform, because you don't meet your own kids with the police detective uniform. And then she takes off the gaze. She takes off the eyes of the detective, because you don't want to meet your own family with the eyes of the detective. Like when I come into my house, my partner always say, if we have a fight, this is the psychologist in you talking. Please leave the psychologist out, come back, and let's talk, and don't mention my mother again. So it's like, we choose to be blind to certain elements of our nation, of our parents, of our kids. I think my daughter is the sweetest girl upon earth. If you saw her screaming in the airport, you wouldn't think she's the sweetest person on earth. Okay? I choose to be blind. I choose to look at her behind the veil in order to love her the way a parent should love his child. And Liat chooses, I think, unconsciously chooses to be blind to certain elements of her husband, because she's a good detective, but she's doing a really bad job here. And I think we as Israelis choose to be blind to certain elements of our country.
My wife is a psychologist too, and I can say you can't leave it outside. It's just not possible. Other questions or comments?
The sexual tension between Eitan and Sirkit. I think the question was it just to make us turn the pages, or was it something into it? So I'll say two things. First, I define myself as a plot junkie. I really like plots, and I wanted the plot to be very compelling. But in the deeper level, I think about knowledge, the Hebrew word for knowledge, ladat, ladat isha, ladat gever, the biblical term of the word knowledge also refers to sexual intercourse. So that when I say ladat isha or ladat gever, in English he knew her. If I was talking in biblical Hebrew, it means knowledge of the flesh. And I think Hebrew is a very smart language, because there is something erotically charged with somebody who knows your biggest secret. I think there is something both intimidating but very, very attracting in the idea that somebody knows you from the inside. So Sirkit, this Eritrean lady, because she was there in the moment of the accident, she knows this Israeli doctor more than anybody. She definitely knows him better than his wife, better than his mother, better than himself. And the erotic tension between them, I think is the tension, the charge that you have, being both intimidating because she's blackmailing him, that's the worst thing that ever happened to him. But this is also the best thing that ever happened to him, because this is the only chance that he has to really know himself. And when I was trained as a psychologist, I was working in the psychological services of Tel Aviv University, so I was working with students. And my instructor told me, the first day, she told me, people are going to come here and to fall in love with you. But it's not about you. Don't get flattered. It has nothing to do with you. They don't fall in love with you. They fall in love with the secret that they put in the room and that you're keeping for them. And I thought about Eitan and Sirkit. She holds the secret. And he cannot but be drawn to somebody that holds the secret. And on the other side, for her, he is the person that killed her husband. He is a terrible person. But he is also the person that woke up everything that was asleep inside of her. She owes him everything. And this is, once again, to owe somebody means that you have a very strong connection with him, of both eroticism, but also of, I think, even hate. Waking Lions. I was sitting in the house of Dorit Rabinyan. She's an Israeli author. And I told her, I have a problem because I have a novel that is going to be released soon and I don't have a name. And with babies, it's okay. You don't name them until they're out. But with a novel, you have to. And then we spent the evening talking about the novel and looking into poetry books and talking about links. And then I remember, she called it like you open in tarot, liftoch beklafim, you open. It was like opening in poetry. You open and something comes up. And then this was this beautiful poem by Yonah Volach, the Israeli poet. And in Hebrew, the היינו כמטורפים כל הלילה שהגו בנו הריות. In English, we were as madmen, lions roared in us all night. And when I read this, I came back to the manuscript and I read it throughout and I thought about the idea of a lion roaring inside. And I thought about both from the erotic perspective, that something is roaring inside of you this night when Eitan and Sirkit are sharing the same, they're not sharing the same bed, but they're sharing the same space for a whole night and something roars inside of them. But I also thought about the idea of a hidden predator, like a hidden lion that lies inside all of us. And we don't think of ourselves as lions, as predators. We dress up and we're nice people and we don't like to think of ourselves this way as beasts. We use words in such interesting ways to not recognize this part in us. Like I have people coming to the clinic saying, I don't know what got into me. I beat in my wife. Or it was something that came over me. I cheated on my husband. Or it was like this demon talking out of my throat when I open. We use the language to distance the aggressive part or the sexual part. So it's something getting over me, or what is it that took over me? Or there is the me, which is always nice, and then there is the predator, which is external. Like Oedipus, he thinks it's external. But there is a lion. And Eitan, the car accident, is the moment where he has to face the fact that there is a predator inside of him and how far he's willing to go.
You commented on the different register of language of your two novels, the difference in the tone, the music of the language. And they are, to be sure, two very, very different books. But at the same time, they're both about refugees. I wonder, what is that? I mean, there are two different stories, but they can also be seen, in a way, as the same story flipped.
Wow.
So, do you have any thoughts about that?
It was worth coming all the way to New York. I never thought about that. So thank you. Not just in the literary level, but also I think it's... You could say it in a clinic and I would pay you 400 shekels.
Oh. Yeah.
But it's a literary event, so I get it for free. I think there is a sentence by Roman Gary, the Jewish-French author, and he talks about the claustrophobia he feels inside his own skin. And when I read it, at first I was a teenager, but I felt I know what he's talking about, being claustrophobic inside your own skin. And I think about this feeling of being a refugee inside your own skin and sometimes inside your own family. And how uncomfortable it is, and yet how necessary it is, I think, for writing. And I think the issue is refugees for me as an Israeli. I come from a family of refugees. My grandfather, he's 93 years old now, and he walked half of Europe to get to Israel. And the idea of those refugees walking to get to the promised land, not just, you know, crossing the Sinai Desert, walking to get to the promised land, because the journey that the Eritreans are doing right now, it's amazing how ironic history can be, because geographically it is the same journey. And then I'm thinking, those people are crossing the desert to get to the promised land. And now you have us, the Israelis, being a nation of refugees, but we are not the gatekeepers. And you ask yourself, will we show more compassion because we know what it means to be a refugee? Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe, I remember I worked with a kid who was beaten up in elementary school. And I thought, what will happen to this kid when he'll grow up? Will he be like never beat anybody because he knows what it feels to be beaten up? Or on the contrary, will he be aggressive because he knows what it means to be weak and he's never going back there again? And I think you're right. Malkovich refuses to remain a refugee. And he's being so aggressive trying to find a place in the world. And learning, I think, in the hard way, that you cannot find your place only through being aggressive. It doesn't work.
You mentioned you did some research by speaking with doctors about borders. If there were to be a situation, as in the book, with a refugee camp, as you described it, in Omer, would the Bedouins and the Eritreans
be comfortable with each other, or would they be at odds with each other because they're
each in their own client's camp separately?
You know, it's a good question. And I'm sorry. The question was, if there really was such a group of Eritreans in the desert, like a small refugee camp or this hospital, will the refugees and the Bedouins get along together, or will it be two different groups? I was working in the Israeli civil rights movement, and I met with a Bedouin woman that was black. She was a Nubian Bedouin woman. And she told me, you know who is even more racist than the Israelis? And I said, who? And she said, the Bedouins. The Bedouins towards the black Bedouins are very, very racist. Nobody wanted to marry her. Inside the Bedouin community, nobody wanted to marry her because she was Nubian. She was very, very dark. And she said, you know, you would think that the Bedouin society suffering discrimination would show more generosity towards a Bedouin woman, which is like from a lower caste, you would say. But no, it comes again to this kid. I think we always need somebody to be weaker than us in order to feel that we have power. I mean, in a way, you also see it with family dynamics, right? If I was going in New York, when I go in New York alone, I always feel like I don't know where I'm going. I'm clinging to the first person I meet. I'm holding the hand of my American editor because this is such a big city and I'm frightened. But if I was walking here with my little girl, then I would be like this. Mommy's here, mommy knows where we're going, and I won't be lying. I would really feel empowered by the fact I have somebody little holding my hand. It's the same dynamic. I think having somebody dependent on us makes us feel stronger, and we can feel it out of love, saying mommy is here, or we can feel it out of aggression, saying you sit here and I'll kick you away.
No, I'm going to make it easier if this works from here.
Who's that? You?
Yeah. Just wonder whether you had any thoughts on the different treatment of the Vietnamese boat people in Israel, as opposed to the current situation. Seems to be very different from the outside, anyway.
The Vietnamese people where I think it's a different situation, first of all, because of the numbers, because of the fear. There's a great difference between saying we are accepting a certain amount that we decided on of Vietnamese people who will come by a plane. There's no way that they're coming in thousands, okay? It's a pretty long way. And between saying we are accepting refugees coming from Africa, crossing the border by foot, theoretically, you can have any number of in the world if you won't stop this. So I think people in Israel never thought of the Vietnamese as a threat, and that's why they could be more generous. Well, today, many people in the Israeli society are afraid that if we will be too generous, then we will have the phrase that you usually hear in Israel is, you can't have all of Africa coming here. If you ask for my own opinion, I think there's a very wide range of numbers between 100% and 1%. I don't want all of Africa coming to Israel, but currently Israel is giving the status of a refugee to less than 1% of the asylum seekers. And coming from a nation of refugees, I think less than 1% is not enough. I don't think 100% should be, but I just think we have more numbers.
If you don't mind, I'm sorry for interrupting, and I am interrupting, I apologize, but I'd actually like to, rather than discussing political issues, try to stick to the novels.
I think goes to the heart of the moral dilemma
in
the way you want it.
No. You asked that question already,
I'd just like to hear
the follow-up
answer.
Yeah. Ma'am, go ahead.
A different kind of question. What's it like working with a translator? Do you interact? Do you debate some of the words that are chosen, or do you just hand your baby over to the translator? How does that work?
It's a difficult. I don't read English literature. My English is not good enough to appreciate a translation. And at first, I was cheeky enough to think that I can appreciate the translation. And when I read One Night Markovitch, I thought that it lacks the music. And then I gave it to a friend of mine who's an American, and she said, it has music, just you can't hear it because it's not your language, so shut up, take a step back, and let them do their job. And especially with other languages, I mean, that the novel is translated to, I'm sitting in Germany and they do readings. They have an actor reading 20 minutes from the novel, which I think is very boring. And because why would you come to hear somebody reading a novel that you already read? But I sometimes sit there and I think this sounds such so foreign to me, my own language in German. It's as if they could put inside a new character, and I would never be able to tell. Maybe they changed the ending. Maybe. So it's about letting go, you're right.
So before you ask it, let me give you the microphone so that everyone can hear.
You tied all the ends in the book really neatly, and I was very surprised because I was so sure that the two of them were going to end up together.
Spoiler alarm.
Spoiler alert. You know?
but can you phrase it as a? I'll try to answer if you phrase it more ambiguous. You want to try?
Right. Let me talk about the ninja. Yeah. There was an object. Can those of you who didn't read the book close? Everything got resolved. Except there's one
object. No, don't describe how it got resolved. Okay.
Just
to
tell what happened.
Okay. I think about this idea in Judaism that you never finish building a house entirely. You always feel leave one stone unfinished. And when I wanted to Waking Lines to end in a way that will satisfy me as a reader. I usually hate too much open endings. I feel like, come on, make up your mind and lead me to, I need a catharsis, I need the Aristotle way of writing a story. So I wanted it to end, even though while writing it, I didn't want to know the way it ends. Because I had this inside battle that I told you about between a redemption novel and between a more cynic way of looking at it. And to keep this tension, I needed to be ignorant of the end. So I will have those two forces fighting inside my character. I think of it like when you go on hiking. I never understand people who look at Google Maps and look at Google Pictures, at all the pictures from the summit that they're climbing. I mean, why climb all the way if you already saw all the pictures? So while writing it, I didn't want to know the ending, but when I reached the end, I thought, this is the place where it should all get together, but not too much. Because I feel if you tie all everything entirely, then this is not about life. Life is always about coming outside of the door. There's this another beautiful line of Yehuda Amichai. He's saying about how the first kiss always knows it's the first kiss. But the last kiss never knows it's the last kiss. And I think this is so beautiful because I think about the people that I loved and I lost and that I never knew. And I always have this, you know, after you leave, those questions or those words that you wanted to say or those kisses that you wanted to give. And I think this is life. And if an author ties everything up together, then if it's too tied up, you can't breathe.
So you did that purposely?
I did it purposely.
Okay, let me give you the microphone, and we're going to give it the time, and people are going to want to buy some copies and get it, you know, get the book signed. So we'll let those people ask questions.
Among the characters that you created, do you have a favorite?
Wow, that's a good question. I usually love the characters that I have to fight for. I had to fight for Circuit. Because my editor at first told me not to write Circuit from within, but to write her only from the perspective of the Israeli doctor. Because he said, you're a white middle class girl from Tel Aviv. What do you know about being a refugee? So you can write her as this femme fatale. You say femme fatale? Mm-hmm. This femme fatale, or as this riddle, as this threat to the doctor. But don't you dare to try and write her in her own voice. And at first, the first draft of Waking Lines was me trying to write it only from the perspective of the doctor. But then I felt I was silencing her up. I felt instead of having a real human being, I'm having this object of desire or object of hate for the doctor, but not a person. And I thought, there is something dehumanizing in saying that some person is so distant from us that we cannot even imagine, we cannot dare to... I mean, literature is all about, I think, putting yourself in the shoes of the other. I mean, that's the basics for literature and for empathy. I mean, we can cry about something that happened. You read the Bible and you feel like it happened yesterday because it's about people being people. It doesn't matter how long ago it was written. It can be set on Mars. It can be set, I mean, in space or 200 years ago. You can read a novel that's written in a language you don't speak. The characters, you can't even pronounce their names, but you will feel them. Sometimes you will care for them more than you do for people in the real world. So this fight over a circuit made me really care for her. And in One Night Markovitch, I think I really cared for the character of Sonia. She had something of my grandmother, so writing it was, for me, a way to come near to my grandmother.
Are you working on something new?
I just published a novel in Israel, my third novel. It's called The Liar. It will be here next year. I just got the English translation with this email. American, you know, you have this email saying, here's the translation. We really appreciate your thoughts about this. And I thought, you don't really need my thoughts about this. I don't even read English, but you're so nice.
What's the Hebrew title?
In Hebrew, Hashakranit Vehair.
Hashakranit Vehair?
Ken.
Oh, okay.
And in English, it will be The Liar, just The Liar.
Okay, well, I'll order it tomorrow.
That's wonderful. I want to thank you, Ayala, for absolutely... And the only thing I want to add, since almost everyone raised your hand when I asked, had you read Waking Lions, and almost no one raised their hand, I said almost, for One Night Markovitch, until this next novel is available in English, recommend and encourage you to buy. You will absolutely love it. I have to say that when I was reading One Night Markovitch, I remember the moment. I had assumed the title meant something other than in the end it meant, or maybe titles mean many things. But I remember the moment that I gained your insight into the title, and I gasped. Oh. Right? I actually gasped when I read that. So I just have to say, it captures you from within. You will all enjoy that, and it'll give you something to read between now and when's the English version going to appear? And The Liar?
March 19th.
Of 2019?
Yeah.
Great, and so you'll be able to come to the new library and talk about that one sometime next year. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you in September.